If you're like me, you love and miss that golden era of Christian music. From the Jesus music of the 70s, the monster vocalists of the 80s, and the creativity and risk-taking of the 90s and early 2000s. I'm Andy Christman, and for the past four decades, I was privileged to be smack dab in the middle of this crazy and beautiful thing that we call CCM. As a member of the group For Him, I got to know so many great people with even greater stories, and I don't want to keep these stories to myself. That's why I created One Degree of Andy, so you can join me as I reminisce with my friends and colleagues. My hope is that as you experience these conversations, you'll go back and listen to that golden era of music and fall in love all over again, just like I have. This is the One Degree of Andy podcast. This next conversation is one I've waited 36 years to have. I met Roger Breland in 1987 when he auditioned me to join the legendary group called Truth, a group that I was with for more than 3 years and did nearly 1,000 concerts with, and where I met the other guys that would make up For Him. I mean it when I say that the story of Christian music cannot and should not be told without Roger Breland and Truth. With more than 400 members, 10,000 concerts, and 31 years of traveling the world. But you know, the stats really don't tell the story of what God did through this group from 1971 to 2002. I am super thrilled to welcome my mentor and friend to the One Degree podcast, Roger Breland. As always, before we get started, I want to invite you to become a premium subscriber, just like Lisa, Jackie, Scott, and Joel have done recently. Your generous support gives you early access to episodes and helps us continue to create awesome content. Just hit the link in the podcast subscription. It's super easy to sign up. And Christmas will be here before you know it. And I bet you already have your decorations up. I don't personally, but my wife and I are typically last minute with the tree and all the tchotchkes that we put around the house. Anyway, I want to tell you about the Christmas story. Read the Christmas story like never before. Embark on a captivating and immersive experience with your loved ones as you journey through the Gospels and relive the wonder of Jesus' miraculous first coming. With stunning visuals and compelling storytelling, the greatest story ever told will come alive in your living room. Each book also includes a QR code unlocking a dynamic digital experience. Read along to a powerful original soundtrack, watch animations on your TV, and enjoy an ebook and audiobook version narrated by Willie George, founder of Church on the Move, that's my church, in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Lead your family well this Christmas with this easy-to-use, power-packed storybook experience. Get yours right now at andychristman.com or readthechristmasstory.com and enter the promo code Andy for 10% off your order. All right, here's my conversation with, man, one of my favorite people in the world, Roger Breland of Truth. So one of the reasons I started this podcast was I feel like I have a unique perspective on Christian music from the just growing up watching it in the 70s, listening to it in the 70s, being a part of it in the 80s, 90s, and early 2000s, and having just met or come across so many people in the industry during that time and becoming friends with them. And one of the taglines that I've come up with is you can't tell the story of Christian music without. And I would say this might be one of the pinnacle conversations of that statement, because you literally cannot tell the story of Christian music without Roger Breland and Truth. Because no matter where you look, I don't care if it's the CMAs, the Grammys, the Doves, anybody on the charts right now, just look up and down. You're going to see somebody that either got their start in Truth, or like several people that I've had on here, like Jay DeMarcus, Travis Cottrell, Michael O'Brien, who all wanted to be in Truth and it just didn't work out. I think this entire industry has a thread of Roger Breland and Truth all through it. Like, you literally cannot tell the story of Christian music without Roger Breland and Truth. So it is an incredible privilege and an honor, because it's where I got my start and I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for you. So welcome, with great excitement on my part, to the One Degree of Andy podcast, Roger Breland.
Well, thank you, Andy. I'm so very pleased I could be here. And it's such a joy for me to to sit back and see what God has done. And, you know, it's, you know, I found out at this point in my life, it's not so much about the music. It's about the people. And God sent us wonderful people. We didn't even realize what God was doing at the time. I remember meeting a guy at the Denver airport one evening. We were flying out after Estes Park. He was quite a well-known contemporary musician at the time. We were probably considered that group that, you know, just changed people a lot. That was not the cool thing to do from a Nashville perspective at the time, but little did we know, it was a training ground for what God was going to do in the future. And I was most impressed with the guy I was standing next to in the airport at Denver that night. And I introduced myself and I said, "Hi, I'm Roger with Truth, and we were on tonight at Estes Park." And he looked at me and said, "Oh, yeah, you're that guy with the pretty group." And I thought, well, I really do not know how to respond to that. And I guess we're known for a lot of things, but most of all, I guess we did try to look fairly good. But in the 70s, it was, and I guess that we were a little prettier than some of the looks that were going on in those days. But I won't ever forget that. If I told you the name, you would know immediately who it is. But he was pretty much a rocker. But it's, you know, when we run across people today that tell us, "Hey, I auditioned for Truth," or "I was in Truth," and I'm just so thankful for the 400 people.
Wow.
That rode the bus.
Wow.
For 31 years.
Incredible. And it's a shame that something like Truth doesn't exist right now, because that's one of the things I bring up every time. I do a lot of coaching and mentoring. I do a lot of vocal coaching as well. And one of the things I tell them is that I'm sorry for you that you don't have a vehicle like I did. Where else are you going to sing 340 concerts a night for two and a half hours and rehearse on a bus, go in and make a record every 8 to 9 months? I mean, I got my 10,000 hours of singing in 3.5 years riding that Truth bus. And I know you never liked us to say this, but for so many of us in Truth, we would call it Christian Music Boot Camp, because when we got off the road, it was a totally different thing. We were like, "Oh man, we can do 120 dates easy. We can take some time off." You know, it wasn't the grind that Truth was. And so when you're in it, you feel one way. When you're out of it, you feel differently. And you look back on it going, there's no way I would have become who I was without those years on the bus. So, you know, I did 1,000 concerts, Roger. I did 1,000 concerts in Truth before I ever stepped on stage with For Him. And I don't know where else you're going to get that anywhere.
Well, it's just a new day. And, you know, after 31 years, we came to a time where you just couldn't book 6 or 7 days a week.
Right.
I mean, back in the old days, they had things like revivals where they had things that happened Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. You know, they had a Wednesday night opportunity. These days, it's difficult to book a Sunday night.
Yeah.
And I'm still booking 150 dates a year right now at the university with the Voices of Mobile. But, you know, times changed and the church changed in so many ways. Not that it's not vibrant today, it is, but it was particularly exciting in those early days. And in the Deep South, we were kind of the first group in the deep, deep South with a band, you know. Bill Gaither told me once, he said, "You know, Roger, I always like to hire your people." He said, "Because they knew how to work."
That's true.
And you know, we hired a new guy with us once, and he came to a concert. He was auditioning, even like you did once. And he looked on the stage, and he saw all that equipment and the lights and everything. He said, "Wow." He said, "This was really a terrific night. Who sets up all that stuff and takes it down?"
And I said, "I'll give you a wild
you
guess.
You do. You do." And we always said the ground was level at the cross and at the truck.
Yeah.
Because nobody is clapping and giving you a standing ovation after the concert when they've all gone home and we're loading the equipment and driving all night to the next day.
I remember you offered me an extra $10 or $20 a week to be the loadmaster on the bus.
Oh, very important position.
And it was a very important position because we didn't get set up and we didn't get out, you know, out of the parking lot after the show unless that truck was packed the right way and that gear was all taken care of. And and the teeth that had to be pulled to get certain members of the group to you know,
some of God's
come
people,
out of hiding or get out of their bunk and say, get out of here. We need your help.
Some of God's people just move quick, you know. they would detour a bit. We had one that always wanted to go into the fellowship hall and thank the ladies for preparing the meal.
Are you talking about Kirk?
No, but he always managed that we were unloading the truck, but he was in there thanking the ladies for cooking dinner and having a glass of iced tea with them while the other guys were unloading the truck. It was some funny moment, some unusual memories, but
it was great ones. It was quite the, you know, it was a microcosm of what was going to happen when you got out in the real world. Everything was condensed on the bus. We used to call the bus kind of a rolling fish tank, because we kind of had our own political system.
We did.
Our own rules that didn't, you know, weren't going to be the same once we got off the road. But it was necessary to keep, you know, when I was on the road, 24 people, all between the ages of 22 and 32, you know, that were, you know, most not married, and it was co-ed, and it was a lifestyle was always on the go and always moving, and you had to have certain rules and things that just kept things from flying off the, you know, off the road.
We know, and I say this often, particularly when I do a workshop or something, but I lead leaders, and leaders are difficult to lead.
That's true.
Because leaders understand how to make decisions. Therefore, we couldn't have a democratic group. We're not going to vote on anything. Because when you lead leaders, if you do not lead them, they'll get nervous and start making decisions.
That's right.
So somebody has to say, hey, this is what we're going to do, and this is how we're going to do it. Now, I'm really open to suggestions, and a lot of the people who travel with me are more talented or even smarter than me. Somebody had to make the final decision, and I carried that responsibility, and it's a weighted responsibility. It's a difficult responsibility. It's sometimes not a popular, but I remember a couple of times just sitting back and saying, okay, I just want you to make all the decisions today. I don't want to make any. You figure out where we're going to go and how we're going to eat and where we're going to stay and how we're going to get there. And by the way, we spent a lot of years on the road without cell phones.
Yeah, that's right.
Pulling the bus over, trying to find directions to even get to the venue or to get to the church. But, you know, it's tough to lead leaders, but it's fun to lead leaders. I'm looking for leaders. Everybody was somebody somewhere. But it's always interesting to get on the bus and find out, hey, that guy right there is better than I am. But from my standpoint, he's probably going to lead, and you're going to have to take his place.
Yeah.
So I'm going to have to get you ready.
Wow, the juggling act. Place. Yeah, that's incredible. You know, I never really thought about that, but you know, I understand now what it took to do what you did then. Yeah. Like, it took me a long time getting out of that to understand you've got to be a special breed of leader to lead that many people for so long. And like you said earlier, it, changing people out all the time. Because
I think most strong leaders do not like to be led.
All right.
They don't like it. They love it. They do not like it. They love it. Because if you do not make that decision, they get nervous. Because they want somebody to make it. Now, they may not like it, but they're a lot more comfortable if a decision has been made. Wow. It's interesting when you look back, and I'm talking to one of them, the people that rode the bus, and how God's really used them, even as he's using you now.
Well, and I'm eternally grateful.
Well,
I would not be here.
Well, I've said many times, it is interesting how God honors ignorance, and I had a lot of that on the road. I did not have a mentor. I didn't know what I was doing, you know, when I started.
Well, let's talk about that. Let's go back to the beginning.
Sure.
And let's talk about how truth started and where the dream came from.
Well, I in those days, it was a minister of music, not a worship pastor. And, and the Jesus music brought great success to many churches. In the 70s, and I came out of a really wonderful church in Mobile, Alabama. Had a large youth choir, 150, 160, and had a small ensemble. We were traveling, and making an album in Hollywood, and we were doing national television, and it was so successful that I thought, you know, I don't want to do this on weekends. I want to do it full time. So I left what was a really lovely situation, very secure for me, and I went on the road, and for 2 years basically starved to death. You know, we're playing churches that didn't have bathrooms. I was in California doing great things, and all of a sudden I'm in, you know, I'm on the flatbed fertilizer truck in Caledonia, Mississippi, and there's no bathroom, you know, and we're just trying to find a place to sing. And we're setting up, and I'm trying to talk the pastor into doing it another night, because nobody's going to come tonight, but maybe a few more people come tomorrow night. I mean, it was tough, but God allowed us to stay out there. You know, we had some opportunities to do some other things which would have compromised the mission. And I almost fell into that trap, but I caught myself saying, hey, I asked God to allow me to do this. And when I start trying to do something else with this group God's given, I would have probably messed up everything. But the early years were tough years. But we had the opportunity to introduce the music of Andre Crouch and Bill Gaither to the church in the Deep South in the early 70s. And it helped us a great deal. Songs like, you know, The Church Triumphant, if you'll remember. Yeah, Get All Excited.
Yeah.
Just some of those great, great songs. My Tribute. We're singing those songs in the Deep South. Church had never heard those songs before.
Wow.
And they liked them, and it opened a lot of doors for us.
So when did you start making albums? Like what was, because it's not, you know, you don't just walk into a studio and make an album. I mean, there's a process to it, and you got to have people behind you, and you got to have distribution, and you got to have all that kind of stuff. So how did a record deal come into play?
Well, I was making albums with my church groups before I went on the road, and I realized in 71 when we left in the summer that I had to have a record, you know. Yeah. So I went to California and had a friend has a studio out there, and we made an album with studio people, and it's called Searching. And when we went on the road the first day, we had an album. And we carried it through December of the first year. And my friend, and I miss him even today, mentor Bob McKenzie, come to Listen to Truth at a convention in Mississippi. And we signed with the Benson Company in 1972.
Wow.
And we started that journey in Nashville. And we recorded, I think, 61 albums in 31 years. And really recorded a few more than that, because we helped some others.
Incredible. Do you have a copy of each one of those?
I do.
Yeah, that's good.
I do. In fact,
I was at a record store today down in Columbia, and I found an album that actually had, it was a compilation album, but it had Gentle Hands on it.
No kidding.
I took a picture of it and sent it to Kirk, because his name was on there.
But, oh, yeah.
Yeah.
In fact, Jason's with me today, and about 3 months ago, my friend in California who owned a studio passed away, and his wife sent me a tape that had been missing for over 50 years.
Oh, my goodness.
Of the first album, and we took it to...
Was it the master?
We're like, not sure. Okay, it's surreal. Yeah. We're not sure, so we took it to a place here in Nashville for them to burn it and to find out what's on it. But it's been missing for 50 years, and she found it and sent it to me.
Oh, how exciting.
Pretty remarkable.
Wow. You know, there's more stuff out there like that. And I hope that as people listen to this, that it encourages them to, you know, to continue to build that archive. You know, I think that's one of the great legacy pieces of anyone that's lasted this long in the ministry, is that I've even forgotten, even before him, there are songs that I've forgotten about that we did kind of as one-offs, and somebody will bring it back to him and go, I've got to have that. I need that for my grandkids, or, you know, it's something I want to pass down.
Well, what's old is new again.
Yeah, that's right.
It's just amazing. Mm-hmm. And it's fun to hear those songs again. I love them.
So you've had quite an incredible group of people come through Truth. You know, the first person I think of is Gordon Twist. I think of Steve Green. You know, I think of course, For Him and Jana Long of Avalon. I think of, yeah, Jody McBrayer, and some girl who's just sang the national anthem at a football game. I don't remember her name.
Little girl from Seattle.
Yeah.
was with me a couple of years.
Oh yeah, Natalie Grant, of course. Natalie. Yeah,
I'm proud of Natalie.
But yeah, so I mean, and again, you know, like we said earlier, so many musicians out there that are A players, like first call players in LA and Nashville and even New York. Where did you start to? How did you start to draft these types of musicians and singers into Truth in those early days?
You know, I was a bit compromised when I was in college and graduated because I was a school teacher and worked in a church, and I was a drum major in college. So I couldn't figure out how to put all of that together in the church, because in those days, about the only thing you'd hear in a church is three trumpets on God of Our Fathers, you know, and other than that, you couldn't do it. And we certainly in the mainstream churches didn't have drums. But I heard a group once, and I'll have to give credit where credit's due. I heard Thurlow Spur and the Spurlow.
Oh, wow.
Out of Detroit, and they came south. And when I heard that sound, I was always a big band guy, Glenn Miller, but I never could incorporate that into the church. And when I saw that and heard that, I knew that was what I was searching for. So I even asked Thurlow once, I said, hey, I think I could go on the road and direct a group like that. He said, no, you need to stay in the church and doing what you're doing. I said, no, I'm going to do that. And so I did.
Yeah.
And and that's how it all started for me, because all of a sudden I could hear what a rhythm section and a horn section could do. And trumpet players know trumpet players. Saxophone players know saxophone.
Yep.
Piano players know piano. Drummers know drummers, you know. The trickle down from all of that is very, very interesting. So the people in Truth were great recruiters for me. You know, singers know singers, you know. And so that really helped over the years. But, you know, for years after the concert, we'd have auditions every night.
Yeah.
They'd line up outside the choir room and people just come and audition, you know.
Wow.
And I think we counted once, several years ago, we had about 60 people in Nashville who were in Truth, who were part of this working here. And, that's a great legacy. I'm proud of that.
Yeah. No, and not just musicians, but people running studios labels. And ministers of music everywhere. Jason, and your son, John, who's a senior pastor in Mobile, and then Jeremy, who, you know, was in a booking agency and now just climbing that corporate ladder everywhere.
Yeah.
You know, it's amazing not only to see so many musicians have success outside of Truth, but even your own family. And I think that's a real legacy for you, I know, because that's not always the case.
Well, I'm grateful and so proud of those guys to see. And I say guys, you guys, to see what you're doing. You know, it's just fun to sit back and watch. Now at this point in my life, I'll be 80 this year. I went on the road when I was 27 years old.
You look amazing.
And I'm still out every weekend with, you know, still traveling, you know, and it's been a great ministry for me, and one I never dreamed that I would have.
Well, let's talk about some of the people that have come through, I think, that are cornerstones in the ministry and the legacy of Truth. Again, I think of Gordon Twist. I think of Joe Estes. I think of Kim Noblett. You know, when somebody like Joe or Kim come along, they kind of stand out. I don't know if stand out's the right word, but they become cornerstones you can build around for long periods of time. Talk to me about several of these people that kind of came through in those
days.
And
it's really interesting. Some of those people really didn't want to come on the road at all.
Really?
I mean, Gordon Twist was in the Air Force.
Oh, that's right.
I went to the commanding general of Maxwell Air Force Base and said, hey, can I get this guy out of the service 6 months early? He says, well, if his commanding, his officer will let him, I'll let him, but they didn't. I had to wait 6 months. But and Gordon, you know, had a tremendous influence. He was a musician's musician.
Yeah.
He was a great example of excellence, you know?
He was in my life. I would tell you, I go back, when I trace back my career, it all leads to Gordon.
Yeah.
Was just that spark plug in me that helped me get to that level that I didn't know I could get to.
Great Gordon story. We're in Beaumont, Texas, and we had a great concert. And Gordon traveled with us for many, many years, but I would bring him in as a clinician, you know, because he was working out of New York.
Right.
And I've forgotten the album, but it was Gentle Hands. You talked about that.
Yeah.
And so Linda Dove and Kirk are singing Gentle Hands. And they sang it that night in Beaumont, and Gordon was in the concert taking notes. And I'm not sure that Gentle Hands was a standing ovation that night, but it was the equivalent thereof.
Yeah.
And according to Gordon's always back by the sound console taking notes. And so we had a full day's rehearsal the next day because I wanted him to sharpen things. And he looked at Linda and Kirk. He said, Now tell me your name. What are your names? And so I said, yes, now I listened to you sing that song, and I noticed that there was a huge response. He said, but I didn't respond. He said, the difference between me and the audience is I'm a musician, and today I'm going to teach you how to sing that song.
Oh, man.
It was a terrific moment. He was always challenging you to take it to another level.
You've got to have those people in your life.
You have to.
And as much as it hurts, as much as you don't want to hear it, it's people like Gordon and you. I mean, you were that way as well. I mean, you wouldn't let us just do whatever we wanted to do. You knew what we were capable of. And you have to have those people in your life to make you uncomfortable to push you into that next place. And that was Gordon.
It's great to be able to sing a good song. But it's greater when not only can you sing it, but when you own it, that's when it's a great song.
Yeah.
And there is a difference.
That's right.
And people, many times the audience, they do not know how to describe the difference. They just know the difference. It's like the anointing of a God, you know? It's not a matter of just saying, I've got it.
Yeah.
You know? But all of a sudden, when the anointing of God is there, everybody in the house knows it.
Yeah. You know? And I, you know, just in my experience, you can feel the anointing when someone sings. I mean, you can feel it. You can feel like a trace of it, or you feel the whole thing. Yeah. But I always found it's in the hard work that releases the potential or releases the full magnitude of that anointing. It's not just hard work, but you have to surrender to the will of God and everything that you're doing. But, you know, again, night after night after night after night and singing on stage with these incredible vocalists and musicians that you put together, you couldn't take a night off. I mean, you couldn't.
No.
You were always, you know, you said you listened to the For Him podcast that we did. And, you know, I think a couple of us mentioned it. Kirk said it, and I agreed with him, that you felt like you were singing for your life every night because of the amount of talent that was around you. You know, it's not like you were competing, but you kind of were.
Yeah, but it's not only you're singing for your life, you're singing the message for somebody else's life out there in the audience because
you're right.
of the message.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I thank you for being a good singer. Thank you for singing a good song. But I want to know, not only do you believe it, can you sing it, but can you live it?
Well,
can you live what you're singing? And if you can live it and sing it, it makes all the difference in the world.
That's right.
You know, thank you for being a good singer. There are a lot of great singers out there, but there's another dimension when you live what you sing.
So you're always famous for saying you were in search of a lovely moment. In fact, that's the name of your biography, in search of a lovely moment. And you were so good at putting albums together, finding the right songs with the right people. I know you had help with producers.
I really did.
And all that as well. You know, a truth concert experience was an experience. And that doesn't just happen when you string a bunch of songs together with a bunch of good vocalists. You knew where a moment needed to go, and you knew how to, don't take this the wrong way, you knew how to milk it a little bit. You knew how to stay there or push it to that next place. And, you know, again, not lost on me as a worship pastor later on, putting together worship services to go, where's my beautiful, lovely moment?
Right.
Well,
you know, you can go anywhere one time and you can walk out and say, hey, you know what? I'm going to do whatever I want to do tonight. Really? Well, that's good. Famous last words.
Yeah.
When can you come back? And I never really felt that truth was necessarily the top of the ladder. But there are a lot of people who had a lot of big hits that flamed out. And I think we were kind of in the middle. And I think most of the people would trust us. And I always tried to do what they wanted us to do. I mean, I've been asking the same question every week for 52 years. Hey, Pastor, what would you like for us to do? Now, once again, you get on the platform, you get the mic, you can do anything you want to do. But famous last words, when can you come back? And the chances are, if you do well and you're honest about it and you really prepare, you know, not only can you come back, but the crowd might be larger, you know, the honorarium might be better, sales might be better, you might even have more fun. But how do you last, you know? There are lots of people who've had huge albums.
Yeah.
One time.
Yeah. Right.
One time. Yeah.
Or like you said, one big song and then you never hear from them again. And, yeah. You know, I think I can speak for so many artists that came out of Truth that the heart of what we did, we learned from you, and that is preach the gospel. And I know for him, we gave an altar call every night.
Yes,
I don't care if it was at First Baptist Church or if it was at a bass rodeo.
Right.
You know, we were gonna give an invitation because that's what you instilled in us to do. Is it was a purpose that we had. And, you know, the same idea of what do you need us to be tonight? What do you need for him to be tonight for you? And we got that from you and from Truth, and we heard that all the time.
Well, we're guests.
Yeah.
You know, we need to be good guests.
Yeah, that's good.
You know, I want to be. I spoke to a pastor today. He called me at lunch. We're going to be at his church, and he just said, "Is it okay if we do this that night?" Or I said, "Okay, we have dinner here." So I said, "Hey, we'll do anything you want us to do. You know, we're flexible. You know, if you're going to travel, you got to be flexible because." You ride that bus, you know, you may want to sleep in that day and we have to leave at 6, you know, you can't be, you know, you can't just go in and order a meal. And we ate a lot of the gospel bird over the years, you know, we ate a lot of chicken, you know, so just being able to, well, it should be an honor to be invited anywhere.
You're right.
And then for people to spend part of their life with you because they come to the concert. And you guys and For Him did such a great job at that, you know, but you knew how to work. You literally stepped off our bus and on your bus.
Yeah.
And had the number one record in the country when you stepped off our bus. Mm-hmm. And you knew how to work, you know?
Yeah.
And I listened to that podcast, you know?
what do you want to correct?
where do I start? You know? No, listen, this is the way it should start. You asked the guys in that podcast, tell us how you got in Truth. Well,
yeah.
I still owe you apology after apology because I sent you to the wrong town.
You did. Yeah. I love that. That's one of my favorite stories to tell.
But I sent you to the right airport.
You did.
It's just that airport serves several cities, you know? We were in... and I think you said it well, you know, if you could find the church that night in the wrong city, I want to hire a guy like that.
Yeah.
You know, that's what
that's exactly what you said. You're like, you're a pretty good singer, but you figure out how to get here. I could use a guy like that.
And I really love that.
Yeah. You know? I will tell you a little more about that story. So there's a lady that was, I was at a hotel, I think it was a La Quinta. So my dad had paid for the flight out.
Right.
I had some spending money from, you know, left over in my checking account. That's how I paid for the cab that drove me all over Greenville for several hours. And then he bought me a room at a La Quinta. And after I had finished driving around that afternoon, I went back to my hotel and I was just like, I don't know. And I was in the shower and I had heard my pastor preach this message a few weeks earlier. He said that one of the best prayers you can pray is God help. And so I just did. I went, okay, I'm going to try it. God help. I don't know what to do. And my flight leaves in the morning. I just don't know what to do. And the Holy Spirit said, you got to remember, I'm Southern Baptist. So, you know, God speaking to me was kind of like, what was that? I don't know what that was. He said, go pick up a newspaper. And I was like, okay, so dried off, went to the lobby, picked up a newspaper, took it back to my room, started reading through, and I saw something about Mississippi State volleyball team, Starkville, Mississippi. And it jogged something in my memory. Mr. Breland said, we're close to Mississippi State University. And I was like, oh, I'm in the wrong town. He's at Faith Baptist, but it just dawned on me. So I walk across an interstate. There's a big Baptist church across the street. across the interstate. I walk across the interstate and it's a Wednesday night. Nobody around. Maybe Wednesday at like 5 o'clock.
Right.
And I just see a car parked at this door. I knock on the door. It's a back entrance to a kitchen. And a lady opens the door, kind of like, you know, looks at me like wondering if I've got a gun or something. And I said, hey, I know you don't know me, but here's my story. And standing there at the door with her, got that door cracked open, I told the story. And she said, you know what? I think my son told me about that concert. And she brought me in. She called Faith Baptist Church wow. in Starkville and confirmed that Truth is going to be there. She said, jump in the car. Jump in the car.
No kidding.
No kidding.
Wonderful.
And she drove me 45 minutes.
Really?
She called somebody to come take her place. She was fixing the food for Wednesday night dinner at that church.
Fantastic.
Got me in her car, got me there. I got there just as the concert started. And this is what's really why I get chills just thinking about this. So years later, I'm living in Mobile during the 4 Hymn days. And I have a camcorder that's not working. So I take that camcorder to a camcorder repair store, a camera repair store. And I give the guy my name. And he said, "And were you in Truth?" I said, yeah. He said, 4 Hymn? I'm like, yeah. He goes, hang on a second. That was his mom.
No kidding.
Calls his mom and said, I've got somebody you need to talk to. So I call her. I get on the phone with her and we cry and we tell that story. And she says, I've been following your career ever since.
Fantastic.
She said, I think back to that day when I wasn't sure if I should open that door.
Wow.
And take you. And he said, I don't know why I did it. She said, my son was so furious at me saying, mom, you don't know who that guy could have been that you got in your car. She said, but I felt a piece about it. And she gave me her phone number. I gave it to my mom. And until the day she passed away, she and my mom talked once a month.
No kidding.
And my mom would call her and they developed a friendship. Isn't that wild? Isn't that just like God just to go, hey, I know all of this and I'm going to remind you of this later on. So it's a blessing in your life. And, you know, you look back at that and just go, God, you're in the story.
Just an angel.
Right?
Just an angel.
And I know you have tons of stories like that to where, I mean, I was around in some of those days where like, guys, I don't know, you know, where payroll is going to come from, or I don't know how we're going to get the bus fixed, or I don't know, you know, you were a faith leader for us as well, not just our musical leader, but you are a faith leader as well. So many times that you would just come in and say, God's people, we got to pray. And we believe God's going to do it.
Well, I think one of those stories that really kind of shook me was we got a phone call in the office one day, and the guy says, hello, my name is David. And he said, I haven't seen Truth in 12 years, he said, but I was a juvenile delinquent, what he said, in Fairhope, Alabama. He said, Truth was singing a concert in the First Methodist Church. And he said, there's a godly girl in the senior class who was determined to get me to that concert that night. And I didn't go to church. But because she invited me, I went with her. And he said, you did the concert. He said, it was good, but said, Roger, you gave the invitation, and I came down that night and got saved. He said, I got up off my knees, and I went to Bible college. He said, I haven't seen Truth in 12 years. He said, my dad sends me the tapes. He said, I'm a pastor now, and he said, I'd like to know if you'd come and sing in my church. And it was such a great story, and I had never heard the story. I said, well, yes. I said, tell me about your church. He said, well, we're finishing a new building, and if you'll come, it would be a blessing to us. And he said, it seats 10,000. And I'm thinking, 10,000? There are only a couple of churches in America.
I was about to say, I can only think of one.
And we had been in those churches.
Yeah.
I said, David, where's your church? And he said, Manila.
Manila. Yep.
And so you know the rest of the story.
Yeah.
And we've been several times. And I know this sounds like an exaggeration. We were there. You were with us, were you not?
Yeah.
And that first time, I think we were there 10 or 12 days. I've forgotten how long.
We were. I think we did 20 concerts in 12 days.
Yes.
Something like that.
And we had We had 20,000 people saved.
That's right.
Now, that's not exaggeration, because the follow-up after every concert was incredible. We had 20,000 cars. You remember?
Yeah.
He had hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people to counsel. And it was just an amazing time. And we sang in places where a communist university, where they're walking around with machine guns on top of the stands. Mm-hmm. You know? But David Summerall has a great ministry. He has campuses all over the world. And I've told that story, as you know, many times. And I'm thankful for that. But wonder what God must be thinking about a high school senior girl that invited David to come to the concert. So the trickle down from that invitation has touched the world.
Wow.
Because of his ministry. And stories like that, that's a God thing. I mean, I'm not that smart. I mean, we were not that good, you know? But that's some of the things that God's done, and we'll always remember those.
How many concerts? Have you ever done the math? Do you know how many concerts
I've done?
Truth did? In 31 years, right? 30 or 31?
They did 10,000. And I've done 2,000 in the last 20 years with Voices. So we've done 12,000 concerts.
Wow.
But yeah, Truth did 10,000 concerts. We traveled 3 million miles. Made 61 or 64 albums. Fed 400 people. And a billion blessings.
Yeah, know? Right.
Yeah.
Well, I was just thinking too, when you talk about, you know, we talked about earlier that there was a call to salvation given every single night.
Yeah.
And let's just assume an average of 10 people a night accepted Christ.
Yeah.
That's 120, 200,000 people.
I've never done that kind of math before.
I mean, my goodness. I mean, and not that we would dwell on that, but God will let us know, you know, what that all meant when we get to heaven and stand before him. But you just think about that kind of legacy, not just the musicians that you produced and the careers that you helped push forward. But, you know, if you think about bringing 120,000 people before God at the end of time, going, this is who I preached the gospel to.
Interesting thing happened this week. I was invited to a reception on campus at the University of Mobile, where I work now. And there was a gentleman there who's a retired Presbyterian preacher. I'll just say Dr. Leslie and his wife Barbara were there. And they gave the university a 400-year-old Bible.
Oh, wow.
They're both from Northern Ireland. And he came to the States. They came as a couple, were married. And he became a Christian. And his wife Barbara was not a Christian. And he was looking for a place to go to college, and he couldn't get in anywhere because the transcripts didn't work well those days. So they let him in at the University of Mobile. And he came in 1973, and he graduated in 1975. He went on to become a seminary professor, a college professor, and a great Presbyterian pastor. Has written several books, has all kinds of honors and degrees given to him. But he's giving us this Bible, and in the presentation, he said, "By the way, Roger, I need to tell you a story. This happened this week." He said, "When I became a Christian, my wife was not a Christian. And she just thought I was some kind of weirdo." And he said, "We heard about a concert in town in Pascagoula, Mississippi. And he said, my wife and I went to that concert. It was a Truth concert, and my wife got saved. And they're both retired now, you know." But it was just such a great story because, I mean, you just never know who's sitting out there and what's
right.
What God's going to do, you know?
That's right.
And sometimes it's not the largest crowds that he's doing his best work in, you know?
Yeah.
But that just happened this week. I was just kind of stunned with the story. It was a great story. Mm. Just a great story.
Trust, receive, unchangeable, true happiness.
Ah, I'm so glad you remember.
Well, you said it all the time.
That's great.
And it's some of those things just stick with you.
That's wonderful.
Yeah. Of course, we used to say, take Roger up to the Hilton. Yeah. Or we had a couple of other little things that we would, you know, we were just terrible.
It was just a lot of respect.
So I still get a little nervous calling you Roger. But I am 57. So I feel like I can, but we weren't allowed to call you Roger back then. It was either Mr. Breland. Yeah. JRB.
Yeah. But you know why also.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
There had to be a line. You know, somebody had to say, you know, this is what we're going to do.
You know? Well, and, you know,
and that's tough. Yeah. But we're not going to go on vacation together. You know, we're going to live on the road together.
That's right. You're exactly right. But, you know, when you started, you were closer in age with everyone that you started
with. I was 27.
You know? Yeah. Yeah. And, but then by the time we came along, like late 80s, you know, there was quite an age difference, except maybe with Kirk and and Lanny. Lanny.
Oh, I love Lanny.
He was with me. God bless his soul.
Lanny was with me 17 years. I miss him today.
Oh.
Had his own chair on the bus. You know
yes,
that.
Yes, he did.
I put a chair on the bus for Lanny with his name on it.
Yep.
And he deserved it.
Well, here we go.
I love Lanny.
So many great people. I think of Dave Cleveland. Dave Cleveland. I remember he was newly saved when he came on the road.
He was.
And he would read the Bible and cry and laugh and get all the names wrong. And I was just like, I've never read the Bible. I've been a Christian my whole life. I've never read the Bible. I've never laughed. I've never cried. And he was such an influence on me because he saw things from such a
innocent perspective.
Innocent perspective. Yeah. Yes. Everything he'd been through.
Yes.
And then to see his dad saved.
Yes.
And just the incredible stories of so many people that you brought on the road that, you know, we were from all different walks of life. It was a real community of people. We were all good at what we did. We all came from different parts of the country. We all had different experiences. I was a Southern Baptist boy on the road with a bunch of Pentecostals, a bunch of Church of God, an Assembly of God.
Yes.
And I remember going to, I think I was in the group for about, I don't know, less than a year, and we went to Brooklyn Tab. And I'll never forget, I'm sitting on stage in the first service, and Pastor Cimbala is preaching, and a guy stands up in the back and prophesies. And everybody gets quiet. And then somebody gets up and gives the interpretation. Next service, he's preaching, and a guy in the back stands up and prophesies, and he says, "You be quiet. You sit down. That ushers, get that man out of here." I was so confused. I'm like, I don't know what's going on. And I had to ask. And thankfully there were people on the road with me. Mark Harris, one of those guys, you know, Marty, Travis Laws, you know, who I could sit down, Alicia Williamson, who I could sit down with, go, "I don't know about this. I've heard you guys talk about the spirit in this way. Teach me, I want to know." And those are life-changing moments for me. I have so many core memories about those days. And I just, again, I want to take time throughout this conversation to say thank you, not just for the opportunity to start my career and have a career in music, but to become more of a well-rounded believer, to have more experiences than I would have had I just stayed in my local church, to meet people that I would have never met in my entire life just staying in Stillwater, Oklahoma, or Waco, Texas.
I can tell you how I relate to that, because I was a Southern Baptist minister of music. And I've said this many times, when I went on the road, I really thought God was a Baptist from Mobile.
Yeah.
Because I'm from Mobile, Alabama. I grew up in a great church. I served a great church. I mean, how could we be wrong? What we believe has to be right. And I guess it's probably the only way. And if you're not doing it the way we're doing it, I mean, please. So we're in Boston, and they're in the Baptist meeting phone booth up there, you know? And then I'm going to some places, and they want to check my credentials, and I walk into an AG church, and they're not worried about my credentials. They're just thankful that we're there, and I'm learning all kinds of things. And I learned quickly God was not a Baptist, and he never even wanted to be.
Yeah.
You know? And but he's not a Catholic either. You know, he's not,
that's right.
You know, he's just God, and he's doing a lot of things that I had no idea he was doing. And they are very, very exciting. And I learned so much, and so thankful for those experiences, you know, because you can't put God in a box.
That's right.
I thought miracles were for television preachers.
Huh.
That's the only miracles I knew about, but I experienced miracles.
Yeah, we experienced them in the Philippines.
Absolutely, you know,
huge numbers,
unbelievable.
You
know? I tell those stories often, you know.
Yeah,
and people, there are doubters out there, but hey, you know, you don't have to be there for God to do it. You know,
doesn't
mean he's not going to do it. And we saw it, experienced it, and have since. And I'm so thankful. I'm so thankful for that.
Yeah,
I need that in my life.
Well, I needed it. I remember you taking me shopping one time because I think all I had. I had some cowboy boots. I had some faded jeans. And I had a bunch of t-shirts.
You did.
And you invested in me. You invested in me more than just giving me an opportunity to sing. But you invested in me and like how to present myself.
Well, I can tell you it was a good investment.
Well, thank you.
And I'm thankful.
Thank you very much. It's again, this is like a full circle thing for me to just be able to, I could have never imagined 30 years ago that I would be able to sit here and have this conversation with you. I mean, it's a blessing for me.
I never imagined that God would allow me to do what he's allowed me to do.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm, you know, and you're experiencing that, of course, in your life, mm-hmm. in your family and in your ministry. And to see all of that and sit back and watch it and listen, it's just, it's almost overwhelming. I was always sensitive about what people thought. You know, I wanted everybody to be pleased. And yeah. You'll remember the verse that that was given to me. It's kind of a life verse for truth. And it has been for me all these years. And it's significant because one of my mentors one time, I said something about, you know, I'm concerned about what people will think. And he said to me, what do you mean what people think? I said, well, I'm always sensitive to that. He said, now, so you're telling me you're worried about what people think. And I said, well, yeah. He said, well, you must really think you're important. I said, well, what do you mean? He said, do you actually think that people are thinking about you? I said, well, yeah. He said, well, let me just tell you. He said, they're not. He said, don't worry about it. He said, they got too many problems of their own to be thinking about you, Roger. So don't feel too good about yourself.
Incredible.
You know, so, but 1 Thessalonians 2:4 says, but as we were allowed of God to be put in trust with the gospel, so we speak not as pleasing men, but God which trieth our hearts. That's been a life verse for me. And I want people to be pleased. But when I start looking at the audience saying, are you pleased? Instead of looking toward heaven and saying, are you pleased? And when we please him, there'll be a greater opportunity to please them.
Yeah.
Or we could have never pleased them to start with. You know?
Yeah.
So I had to get that perspective right in my life.
Well, you preach that all the time. And I would say that was residual on so many of us that went on to do other things. And, you know, I know just having been around you for so many years, I know that one of the things that was difficult for you was that the Christian music industry didn't really acknowledge truth.
No, I mean, not at all.
I mean, and again, so many great songs, so many great people that came through, there just wasn't that recognition on Christian radio or at the Dove Awards or wherever that was. How did you deal with that?
Well, and I shouldn't say, when you say that, I shouldn't say they didn't acknowledge us because, I mean, we had really good friends in the industry.
Sure,
and the,
sure.
And the industry in so many ways was helpful and supportive. And they, I mean, you think about the great songs that Stephen V. Taylor found for us. And I think about the years with Bob McKenzie. And I'm, you know, I
We sang songs by Michael W. Smith and Stephen Curtis Chapman. And,
we recorded Michael W.'s first song.
Yeah. Was that New Heart?
Yes, it was the New Heart.
Oh, one of my favorites of all time.
Here's a good
that was one of the first songs you gave me. And let me tell you something, Travis Laws was not happy about it.
Well, we were in Canova, West Virginia at an American Baptist church, not a Southern Baptist church. And we were driving that night from Canova, West Virginia back to Nashville to record. And my keyboard player said to me, Benny Key, he said, hey, he said, there's a guy here who wants to ride the bus back to Nashville with us. I said, what? He said, yeah, I wants to ride back to Nashville. I said, no. I cannot put a guy on the bus like that. Just a young guy. He said, well, he's kind of a friend. I said, no, I'm not. I said, he cannot do that. Well, I should have put him on the bus. And it was Michael W. I mean, he just wanted to give it. So he got a job at our record company. He was stacking records.
Yeah. Well, he wasn't. Was he only like 18 or 19 years old?
Oh, yeah.
And you had a rule. You had a rule of college age or at least.
Right.
Either college grad or college.
But he wasn't
some years in college.
No, he wasn't trying to get in the group. He was just hitching a ride.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, he was hitching a ride.
Yeah, but who knows where that would have led.
Oh, yeah. So, but what Michael did, and I haven't talked about this in a long time, but he, the A&R guy got him to give us cassettes, and he would just deliver the cassettes, but he would sneak one of his songs.
Oh, wow.
And he did, and we recorded.
Oh, wow.
He was still stacking records.
That's still one of my favorite True songs of all time.
It's great.
Oh, and just the way that Kim Nomblett delivered it and recorded it is just an all-time great.
Yeah, it's so many great, great stories like that. And look, you know, we didn't live in Nashville. We were based out of Mobile, which
that does make a difference.
Which I really liked.
Yeah.
Though. I mean,
we did too. So we did the same thing. When For Him went and did our own thing, we loved the idea of not living in Nashville, and we based in Mobile as well. And, you know, I feel like we had healthier families, and, you know, you can put down roots in a different way when you're not living in the place where you work.
And of course, we spent a lot of time here recording. In fact, we recorded our first album, we recorded in early 1972 in Studio B of RCA.
Oh, wow.
And in Studio A, they were mixing the Elvis Live album.
No way.
We thought we were in musical heaven. It was such a big deal. We were in B, and they were mixing in A. It was really something.
So there's a lot of people that I've had on the podcast that were near misses with Truth. So a couple of funny stories was Michael O'Brien, who, when he started talking about auditioning for Truth, I went, wait, when did you audition? And it was right, he was auditioning to replace Mike Eldred. I'm like, that's who I replaced.
Yeah.
I'm like, how in the world? Think about the difference in journeys. I mean, he still did pretty well.
He did very well.
Yeah. But the difference in journeys, it had you chosen Michael and not me. I don't know what I mean, I would have been been an industrial engineer somewhere, you know?
And a good one.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad hope
you came.
So.
I'm glad you came.
Jay DeMarcus, who's now with Rascal Flatts, he told the story of you hiring him, and then he got a call from Benson saying, we'd like to hire you and start East to West with Neil Coomer. And he said, you hung up on him and didn't talk to him for a long time.
You know what? I do not remember that. In fact, I don't remember hanging up on anybody. I heard that story a couple of times, and I mean, that's rude, and I don't want to be rude. I might not have been happy, but I don't remember hanging up.
I know. We all have our exaggerated... We all have our exaggerated memories because they make better stories.
They really,
you know,
do.
Yeah. Who else? Oh, Travis Cottrell. So Travis said that he auditioned like in 92 or 93, and said he auditioned for Alicia. And Alicia said he saw her write in big letters, really nice baritone voice. And he's like, when she wrote that, I realized, they don't hire baritones. They only hire screaming high tenors. Well, I'm like, you're not wrong.
We didn't
about
have
that.
A lot of second bases. That's for sure. You know, they're all.
And he's the biggest Truth nerd ever. It's crazy. I ran into Travis, really got to know him for the first time at Estes Park several years ago. And he walked up and said, oh, I've always wanted to meet you and always wanted to have a conversation with you. And I'm thinking, you want to talk about For Him. And he goes, he starts singing, all that is in me.
Oh, yes.
And I was like, what is happening here? And he starts going, he starts regurgitating all this Truth trivia, all these parts on these songs and asking me questions. I'm like, dude, I don't even know the answer to these things. So yeah, I think you're probably your biggest fan in Nashville is Travis Cottrell.
And see, I didn't know that because I do not know Travis well.
Yeah.
I know who he is. And we're going to do a thing with him, I think, in New York in next spring. With several people, but that's very
cool. He will want to tell you some stories. That's for sure.
And he has done very well.
Yes, he has. And there's just so many. I think of,
Karen Fairchild was with
us. Karen. That's right. Who's with Little Big Town?
Little Big Town has done well. I'm proud of her. Yeah. You know,
Mark Childers.
Mark
is Carrie Underwood's bass player and music director. Yeah,
he and his brother traveled us just. We really had great. I mean, Steve Patrick is still the lead guy in town.
Yeah.
You know, Ernie's on Broadway in New York playing baseball. And I think he's with Aladdin. He's in the pit playing every night. There are just so many. And Dave Cleveland, you know, I think he met him early. I think he's one of the guys that the day he got off the bus, everybody on the bus cried.
That's right.
And then Dana Capolino came.
Mm-hmm. And one of my favorite people in the whole world.
Oh, and he had some big shoes to fill, and he did a great job. Yep. Dana Capolina from Poughkeepsie, New York.
That's right.
How many times did we say that?
He will text me, and I'll just start laughing. And Jackie's like, "Who are you texting?" And I'll say, "Dana." She'll go, "Dana Capolina from Poughkeepsie, New York." I'm like, yeah, that's the only way to say it.
Well,
he's still a very good friend. It's amazing how many of us have stayed connected. Yeah. I stay more connected, obviously, you know, because of what we went through, but I stay more connected with them than I do anybody in high school or college or, you know, in church ministry, anything, because we have such a unique shared experience
right.
from those days in truth. Again, like we said at the very beginning of this, there's never been anything like it and there never will be again.
Well,
but
we had no idea it was really happening the way it was happening at the time. And you look back now, I'm just so thankful for those people, you know. And here's Dana who marries Lee and
Point of Grace.
They've just done such
And the Point of Grace girls all wanted to be in truth.
They did. They auditioned.
Yeah.
They were at Wachita Baptist University.
That's right.
I remember them.
Yeah.
I really
Everybody's
did.
Got a truth connect. That's what's funny is literally everybody I talk to has some sort of truth connection in all of these conversations that I have. And I don't doubt that every conversation past this, someone will have a truth connection.
Well,
either they saw truth, they auditioned for truth, they were in truth, they played on a truth album at some point.
Yeah.
Nikki Leonti, I just had her on.
Did you really?
And I sure did. Yeah,
she was just a child.
She was. She talked about how she got in trouble because during a Christmas concert, she came out dressed as
not a
Frosty the Snowman or something like that, and disrupted the show. And she was like, "Yeah, Roger wasn't happy with me after that."
Well, I mean, to have my sons involved too. I mean, Jason traveled with us for six years and he tells me true stories all the time because, you know, he's the worship pastor at Hendersonville now. And then John and Jeremy were involved and John was on the road with you guys. And,
he was our booking agent for the first couple of years. Yeah.
And road manager and just, you know, Greg Golden and I are still involved. Greg booked truth for 27 years, you know, just amazing people. And the golden voice of Greg Golden.
Yeah.
Awesome.
We always used to picture Greg doing this with the tour dates.
That's right.
So if you can't see what I'm doing, if you're not watching the video, I've got my eyes closed and I'm throwing darts at a dartboard.
Yeah. And you'd say it was just that far on the map, you know. But it unfortunately that's from Seattle to Denver, you know. But the greatest drive I think was Denver to somewhere in the northern part of New York.
Oh my goodness.
And we got there. We did a big Air Force base in Denver, and we started that drive to New York because we had to do a state fair in New York. And we got to New York, and they canceled it because of snow.
Oh.
Yeah. Or we drove to Calgary, Canada, for a big date, and the promoter left town with the money, and they canceled that date.
There had to be so many of those.
Oh, it was just unbelievable.
Yeah.
You know, just stories that just, they don't even sound real.
Yeah.
You know? But, you know, touring Alaska in the middle of the winter, how do you do that? You know, it's just, you know.
But you do it because that's when people in that part of the country come out for concerts. They don't come out in spring and summer.
No.
No, but they need something to do in the dead of winter. And
but you learn.
There we are.
You learn quickly if you're traveling full time that you definitely want to book Florida in January and February.
That's right. And we lived in Florida for a long time, didn't we?
Oh, thank God.
We played every little town, every Baptist and Assembly God church, everywhere in Florida.
I
amaze people when they say, you've probably never heard of such and such Florida. I'm like, I played at such and such church in 1989.
You play Okeechobee, Florida, where there are more cattle than there are people.
That's right.
And
that's right.
You get a good steak there, too.
Yeah. But it was always in the summer, always in the hottest times. And
well, and playing Sunrise service in Miami.
Oh, great memories of that.
Yeah, so you do a concert on Saturday night, and at 2:00 in the morning, you drive down to Miami, and you're setting up.
Yep. On a dock, on a pier.
And you got a 6:00 service, and then you got one that night. I remember one time we were sitting up on Easter Sunday morning out in the middle of that. What do you call that?
It was like a floating pier.
Rickenbacker Causeway.
Yeah.
And we dropped the monitors in the water.
Yeah. Oh, that was Dave Cleveland.
Yeah,
going back to Dave Cleveland. I still remember him going after him.
Yeah, he dove in after him.
Yeah, we're grabbing him
because
he wasn't going to let him go.
No, and we would rather him go than the monitors. We had to have the monitors, you know. I just remember
crazy. You saying, God's people, there's donuts in the dressing room.
Man.
We were like, okay, here we go.
I remember once in Miami where we did two Sunday morning concerts at Perrine. Remember Perrine?
Yeah, I sure do. I remember
that. We did
that.
Two Sunday morning concerts at Perrine. I went to the Super Bowl that afternoon, and we did a concert that night.
Are you kidding me?
I did.
I didn't know that.
Somebody gave me free tickets to the Super Bowl.
Oh,
and it was
my
a
goodness.
Terrible experience for me, you know? I left in the third quarter. But I'm just like, how
what
do you
Super
do
Bowl
that?
Was it?
It was Dallas and Pittsburgh or somebody like that. I mean, it was a good Super Bowl.
Yeah.
But
well,
I
wasn't
like,
my, that wasn't my era.
No, but no. But I mean, I did. Two in the morning, Super Bowl in the afternoon, yeah. Concert that night.
Well, you don't give up tickets to the Super Bowl. You got to go.
No, you got to go.
Yeah.
And,
you
I,
go.
And I did. I'm glad I went.
Yeah.
I left in the third quarter. I had to get to the prayer
you
room.
Because
there are two things. Do not be late to the bus and
That's
do
right.
not be late to the prayer room.
That's right.
It's always 30 minutes.
Oh, my goodness. So many amazing things happen in that prayer room. Yeah. I have so many stories of.
Well, there are a few confessions that they shouldn't have made in this prayer room. Think like, hey, I'm not sure you should have shared that, but people just being transparent and they're being emotional and thinking, oh,
I hope
that's not going to affect the conference tonight. It's like, oh, man, there was some confessions there and I'm thinking, I don't know if I'd have said that.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, my.
Sometime, but they just got to come out
oh,
at some
man,
point. They
yeah.
come out the weirdest times. There were so many marriages in truth because and, you said it earlier.
No dating.
No dating. I think you said it before we got started. No dating. But if you want to date, you got to get married.
Right. Well, you did.
I did. Yeah.
Tell them how you got married.
Oh, well, I got married. So Mark had met his wife, Jody, and hired her because he was the road manager.
Right.
And we're like, we know why you hired her.
Of course.
She was a good singer, but we know why you hired her. So hires Jody to fill up a female spot on the front line, vocal on the front line. And then she introduced me to her best friend, Jackie, who was a flight attendant at the time. Right. And we started dating and got serious. And we decided to get married. I remember I came to you because we were going to go to Hawaii and do some concerts. And we're going to be there like that's 10 days. We're going to do like three concerts.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, that's a honeymoon. And your gift to us was buying Jackie's plane ticket out there. And
But the ceremony...
All right, and I do have a little bit of a bone to pick with you on this one.
So oh, no.
I'm glad you brought this up. So we were going to...
Remember, I bought the tickets to Hawaii.
You did. Yeah. You did. And the hotel as well. Thank you. We didn't have to share a room with anyone, which was advantageous. So we about two nights before we were going to go to go on to Hawaii, we found a church in... it was calm, and I'm gonna have it here in just a second. But it was in Warner Robins, Georgia.
Right around Macon, Georgia.
Yeah, it was Warner Robins, Georgia.
That's right.
And they had a gymnatorium.
That's right.
And that's where we were going to do the concert.
Yep.
And so we had all our family come in. Mm-hmm. Truth was the band. Truth was the congregation.
That's right.
So around 10 o'clock in the morning, before we set up, we got married. And then
before
I said... Before the concert. And then I said, all right, Mr. Breland, I'll see you tomorrow. And he went, no, you'll be here tonight. And I went, I'm going to have to sing on my wedding night. And he goes, yep, you sure are.
That's exactly right.
Yep. And people lose their minds over that. And I'm like, but you know what? That's what we did.
Hey,
I mean,
if you got Andy Crispin in the concert, he's not going to miss a concert.
Holy of Holies must be sung tonight.
Oh, yes, every night.
We have to sing Holy of Holies
tonight.
People
love that song. They still talk about to me about that song.
Oh, Holy man, Holy. That was a real blessing to me. But you did give us the next night off. I think you were somewhere in Atlanta and you gave us that next night off so we could have that next day. But I'm like, so I tell my friends, I'm like, I got married in the gymnatorium the afternoon, the morning before a concert. And then I did the concert that night. And I remember this too. I remember coming in a little bit late to prayer room, which we're not supposed to do. And somebody had done something and you weren't in a very good mood. It was a God's people moment. You were having to correct something in there. And I just walked in I have this memory of you saying, Andy, just walk back out. You can come back in a minute. Because you're like, I don't want you to have to get in the middle of this on this special day of yours. And I walked back out. And then I remember you say, okay, you can come on back in now. And I don't even remember who was in trouble.
Well,
Mark Bovey, maybe. I don't know. That's just the name I remember.
You know, Dan Oxley and Donna here in Nashville.
Yeah.
And Dan is such a great trumpet player. Just amazing guy. Donna's a great singer. Of course, he was a missionary kid from Japan, and she's from Sylacauga, Alabama. So we're getting ready to go on a big trip, and they want to do their honeymoon in Japan because of his family. And so we were making a live album at Mississippi College and Clinton, Mississippi. And we had a small plane in those days. And so Dan and Donna got married in Sylacauga at 10 o'clock on Saturday morning. And the plane flew them after the wedding to Mississippi College that night. We made a live album that night.
Oh my gosh.
And here's the best part. That night, they got on the bus and we drove all night to Tyler, Texas.
No.
On their wedding night.
No.
We did. As God is my witness, we did. Hey. Listen, hey, you know.
You'll have time later.
Yeah.
Yeah, you'll have some alone time later, it but was, right now.
It was interesting.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
So let's talk about this. Let's talk about, I think something that was very validating. Again, you didn't need the validation of Nashville and GMA, but I think it was very appropriate and well-deserved for you to be voted into the GMA Hall of Fame.
Well, I mean, you're very kind, and I was really honored, and I was very surprised. That happened in the year 2000. And a funny story that night, we had it at the Marriott. And we went in, I think it was Petra and Oak Ridge. And there were several people that went in that night. And I can't remember all the people at the time. I think the Kingsman Quartet or something.
Wow.
Several black gospel artists, mm-hmm. wonderful people. So there is the reception prior to the event. And it's a tuxedo night. And, you know, the ladies are in long gowns. And it's a pretty significant night. And so we're in the green room going out. And of course, I'm a truth. And nobody knows us, really. So I'm in the green room and I'm dressed in a tuxedo. And the people who are being awarded, they think I'm the maitre d'.
No.
So they're asking me, you know, you get me a cup of coffee here, can you get me a Coke here. And I said, sure, I'll get it for you.
You did. Holy, it's incredible. Oh, I love that. Is, yeah.
And so they, you know, that. We were going out here and they had no idea that I was even part of the thing until they called me up. And I had a really fun moment with that night. So
I bet you know, did.
As Bob McKenzie said, Roger, you do not need to feel too good about yourself, son. He said, there'll probably be only 100 people at your funeral and only 10 that really care. So I was just, you know, Bob was inducted that night. He had died 6 weeks before. He was my friend of friends. Mm. Had I not had Bob, I don't know what this town would have done to me, but I miss him every day. I wish I could call him today and ask him what he thinks I should do. He's just a wonderful guy. But we went in the Hall of Fame the same night.
Wow, it's
great.
That's wonderful.
Great.
Well deserved. Yeah, well deserved.
Well, thank you.
You know, for him, it's actually been voted into the GMA Hall of Fame.
And that was
COVID
year.
COVID it? Year, and we still don't know what's going on with it. So, well, you know, at some point, you know, we'll be up there with you.
You know, I for you and Marty and Kirk and Mark to do what you've done over the years. I remember I went to the Benson Company. I said, these four guys are going to be special. They are special and they're going to be more special. And if you'll remember, I negotiated a contract, mm-hmm, first one did. For $12,000.
Yeah.
That's how much money we got for that. Mm-hmm. And they didn't know what to think about it until you recorded.
Until Where There's Faith.
Where There's Faith.
Yeah.
Remember the aircraft carrier that some guy on an aircraft carrier. It was just a great story, or was
it? It was a hoax, actually.
Was it really?
It was a hoax.
I didn't.
Well, okay, no. There were two stories. I think the aircraft carrier was it was realistic. Like they played it
right
on the aircraft carrier during, was it Desert Storm?
Yes.
But we got another letter of someone who was like behind enemy lines, and they had a tape. And they played Where There's Faith over and over and over again.
Yeah.
They even had the name of this person. Wow. I think it was a female. Uh-huh. And we had them. We were on Gary Chapman's radio show.
Yeah.
And this story had just come out. And we were making, Benson was making a big deal about it. And this person calls, this is supposed to call in. And instead, it's the battalion leader calls in and says, this person never existed. The whole thing.
Oh, really?
I mean, we're on live national radio.
Wow.
And we're like, well, okay, well, that's a little embarrassing. I remember Gary just going, okay, we'll go on to something else here.
Wow.
But a lot of great stories from that song. We never wanted to record it. We didn't like it. Andy Ivey said, put his foot down and said, you're going to record this song. And
bravo to two Andys. Ivy and you, because it's a standard, and it's just, you know, it was, as I would say, a lovely moment.
It was a lovely
moment. For many people. So I'm thankful for the 4M guys and what they've meant to the kingdom and what they meant to contemporary Christian music, and now what they mean to the world. Mm. Because look what's happening now, the trickle down from that. Wow. So it's a God thing.
Yeah, we're honored. We're just honored to be part of that legacy that you started so many years ago. Before we're done, though, I want to talk about the 50-year reunion, which was one of the most special things I've ever been a part of. It was supposed to happen in 2021,
right?
Because you started Truth in 1971,
right?
And we were supposed to do it in 2021, but COVID put that on pause. So we did it in the summer of 22,
right?
And Father's Day, I think it was right before Father's Day in 2022. And I was astounded by in several ways. First of all, by how many former Truth members showed up. The dinner the night before was such a hoot. And I saw people I never thought I would ever see again at that thing. And then the next night, people showing up and people calling me crying. And that was one of the last times I saw Michael Catt. We lost him just a few months ago, and one of the last times I really got to spend some time with him. Right. It was a special moment for him because he was such a big, big part of Truth in your life.
He was our Truth pastor.
Yeah.
He
was on our board as 4M.
He was. Yeah. I remember. Mm-hmm. And I give the credit to Jason for that, because he put that together. He wanted that to happen. And what Greg Wiggins did with the charts.
Mm. Oh, it's just
amazing. Then Marty steps in logistics Joe. But it was Jason's dream to see that happen, and it did. And I will never forget it. I can't believe that 2,000 people stayed for 4 hours.
It was 4 hours.
I'm on the front row, Jason, thinking, I'm telling Jason, it's too long. But they didn't want to leave.
Well, nobody's going to leave until Church Triumphant plays. You were very smart to leave that at the very end. I mean, that's a smart thing to do. One of the other things I was astounded by was just how good everybody was.
Oh, it was stunning.
And even that group from the early 80s,
yeah.
I just sat there in stunned disbelief at how strong the voices were, how passionate the songs still were coming from their lips, how good everybody sounded together.
It was wonderful. And, I'd been on tour that whole week with Voices of Mobile. I was at Mount Rushmore.
Oh my goodness.
In South Dakota. I flew in on Monday or Tuesday, and the banquet was on Friday night, I think.
Mm-hmm.
It was Thursday, Friday night.
Yeah.
I didn't really even know. I'd been on tour all summer and didn't really know what really was going to happen, because he didn't want me to know.
Well, I'd say that was by design, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. And I sat in wonder. I just wondered what all happened that night in the memories. And, the fact that we had people there from 1971, the first group that were there. Some of them are in heaven now, but we sat there and could chat, and the people could really see from whence it has come.
Yeah.
It was history.
Yeah.
It was just history.
Yeah.
And I won't ever forget it.
Well, there'll never be another night like it. I don't think you can gather those people again.
No, you're right.
Once in a lifetime.
It will never happen again.
I'm so glad that there's an album coming. That's right in my... Right? At three disc. And it's going to be vinyl. Oh, I have to have that. You better make a bunch of those, because this is going to be in demand.
It will.
Yeah. Okay. The voice you're hearing is Jason Breland, one of Roger's sons. And
it's my dream for us to have a Truth Museum at the university.
Oh.
And really, really working on that. And our new Performing Arts Center, which one day God's going to allow us to have it, it's about a $15, $18 million project. But one of the rooms will be the Truth Museum, which is going to cost about $1 million to build, because it'll be next to the Black Box Theater. So there's lots of money to be raised just for the Truth Museum. And I've done a poor job of raising that. We probably raised maybe $100,000 for that. And
that's good, though.
University funds. But we have a lot of memorabilia, all the albums and... even the t-shirts. I mean, can you imagine just the hats and just...
Yeah. It's amazing. A lot of them still exist. Yeah.
And then storage, all the charts, we got all the charts, and people are interested in seeing, between Interstate 65 and Interstate 10, there's a place there that all that can happen. So one day I'm praying that before I go to heaven, maybe I'll be able to see that.
Oh, I bet it happens. I don't see any way that it doesn't. And you know, your ex truth members, the people that you poured into, will be behind that 100%.
I sure would like to see that happen. And I think, you know, there are a lot of people out there who love truth through the years, and I think they'll probably help. Yeah. So we'd love to see that happen soon.
So is there one, I think we need to probably wrap this up, but is there one memory? Is there one core memory for you that when you think back on those days in truth, is there one memory that comes back to you that kind of sums up why God called you to do what you did? I know that might be a big question to ask.
Well, it is a big question, and I'm not sure I'll answer it well, but maybe it's a song. And I remember, you know, we've been on the road 10 years doing 300, sometimes 400 concerts a year. And you're out there in the middle of nowhere, and CCM radio is playing, and all these people are having number ones. And finally, after 10 years, we had a number one song. And it's still a number one song to me and to a lot of people. But Jesus Never Fails was a great moment for us. And then I think the other number one was when Jeff died. My brother-in-law, my sister Debbie, lives here in Nashville with her husband Clint. And when Kim Noblett wrote "If You Could See Me Now."
And Russ Lee sang that, right?
Russ just did a fabulous job. And by the way, I'm really proud of him and New Song and what they've done. I think those moments were really special to me. First of all, If You Could See Me Now, it's family.
Yeah.
And Jesus Never Fails was truth. So those were pivotal moments for us. And then I think to see my sons who stayed home with their mother all those years, and then to see them become involved, and to see that the ministry that they have now, you know, John's a pastor, Jace is a worship pastor, and Jeremy's an executive VP with Dave Ramsey now, and I've got 17 grandchildren.
Wow.
And many of them are ministry people, you know, very involved. A lot to be thankful for, you know.
Hey, thanks for listening. Join me every Monday for new stories from the Christian music industry and beyond. And if you want more content like this, along with a lot of great music, join me for Worship with Andy Christman, airing on 500 stations around the world every weekend. And when you get a sec, run over to my website, andychristman.net, for information about my professional vocal coaching and an incredible new resource for worship pastors called The Worship Table. See you next time on the One Degree of Andy podcast.